This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Sentinel, a Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child and Andrew Child. Read for you by Scott Brick. For Cara and Sarah, with thanks. Chapter 1. Rusty Rutherford emerged from his apartment on a Monday morning, exactly 1 week after he got fired. He spent the first few days after the axe fell with his blinds drawn, working through his stockpile of frozen pizzas and waiting for the phone to ring. Significant weaknesses, the dismissal letter said. Profound failure of leadership. Basic and fundamental errors. It was unbelievable. Such a distortion of the truth. And so unfair. They were actually trying to pin the town's recent problems on him. It was a mistake, plain and simple, which meant it was certain to be corrected. And soon. The hours crawled past. His phone stayed silent. And his personal email silted up with nothing more than spam. He resisted for another full day, then grabbed his old laptop and powered it up. He didn't own a gun or a knife. He didn't know how to rappel from a helicopter or parachute from a plane. But still, someone had to pay. Maybe his real-life enemies were going to get away with it. This time. But not the villains in the video games a developer buddy had sent him. He had shied away from playing them before. The violence felt too extreme. Too unnecessary. It didn't feel that way anymore. His days of showing mercy were over. Unless his phone stayed silent. 24 hours later, he had a slew of new high scores and a mild case of dehydration. But not much else had changed. He closed the computer and slumped back on his couch. He stayed there for the best part of another day, picking at random from a stack of Blu-rays he didn't remember buying and silently begging the universe to send him back to work. He would be different, he swore. Easier to get along with. More patient, diplomatic, empathetic even. He would buy donuts for everyone in the office, twice a month. 3 times if that would seal the deal. His phone stayed silent. He didn't often drink, but what else was there left to do? The credits began to roll at the end of another disc. He couldn't stomach another movie, so he retreated to the kitchen, retrieved an unopened bottle of Jim Beam from the back of a cabinet, returned to the living room and put a scratchy old Elmore James LP on the turntable. He wound up asleep, face down on the floor after he wasn't sure how long. All he knew was that when he woke up, his head felt like it was crammed full of rocks, shifting and grinding as if they were trying to burst out of his skull. He thought the pain would never end. But when his hangover did finally pass, he found himself experiencing a new emotion. Defiance. He was an innocent man, after all. None of the bad things that had happened were his fault. That was for damn sure. He was the one who'd foreseen them, who'd warned his boss about them, time after time, in public and in private, and who'd been ignored, time after time. So after 7 days holed up alone, Rutherford decided it was time to show his face, to tell his side of the story, to anyone who would listen. He took a shower and dug some clothes out of his closet. Chinos and a polo shirt, brand new. Somber colors, with logos, to show he meant business. Then he retrieved his shoes from the opposite corners of the hallway where he'd flung them, scooped up his keys and sunglasses from the bookcase by the door, stepped out into the corridor, rode down in the elevator alone, crossed the lobby, pushed through the heavy revolving door and paused on the sidewalk. The mid-morning sun felt like a blast furnace, and its sudden heat drew beads of sweat from his forehead and armpits. He felt a flutter of panic. Guilty people sweat. He'd read that somewhere, and the one thing he was desperate to avoid was looking guilty. He glanced around, convinced that everyone would be staring at him, then forced himself to move. He picked up the pace, feeling more conspicuous than if he'd been walking down the street naked. But the truth was that most of the people he passed didn't even notice he was there. In fact, Only two of them paid him any attention at all. The same time Rusty Rutherford was coming out of his apartment, Jack Reacher was breaking into a bar. He was in Nashville, Tennessee, 75 miles north and east of Rutherford's sleepy little town, and he was searching for the solution to a problem. It was a practical matter, primarily. A question of physics and biology. Specifically, how to suspend a guy from a ceiling without causing too much permanent damage. To the ceiling, at least. He was less concerned about the guy. The ceiling belonged to the bar, and the bar belonged to the guy. Reacher had first set foot in the place a little over a day earlier, on Saturday. Almost Sunday, because it was close to midnight by the time he got into town. His journey had not been smooth. The first bus he rode caught on fire, and its replacement got wedged under a low bridge after its driver took a wrong turn 20 miles out. Reacher was stiff from the prolonged sitting when he eventually climbed out at the Greyhound station, so he moved away to the side, near the smoker's pen, and took a few minutes to stretch the soreness out of his muscles and joints. He stood there, half hidden in the shadows, while the rest of the passengers milled around and talked and did things with their phones and reclaimed their luggage and gradually drifted away. Reacher stayed where he was. He was in no hurry. He'd arrived later than expected, but that was no major problem. He had no appointments to keep, no meetings to attend. No one was waiting for him, getting worried or getting mad. He'd planned to find a place to stay for the night, a diner for some food, and a bar where he could hear some good music. He should still be able to do all those things. He'd maybe have to switch the order around, maybe combine a couple of activities. But he'd live. And with some hotels, the kind Reacher preferred, it can work to show up late, especially if you're paying cash, which he always did. Music first, Reacher decided. He knew there was no shortage of venues in Nashville, but he wanted a particular kind of place. Somewhere worn, with some history, where Blind Blake could have played back in the day. Howlin' Wolf, even. Certainly nowhere new, or gentrified, or gussied up. The only question was how to find a place like that. The lights were still on in the bus depot, and a handful of people were still working, or waiting, or just keeping themselves off the street. Some of them were bound to be local. Maybe all of them were. Reacher could have asked for directions, but he didn't go in. He preferred to navigate by instinct. He knew cities. He could read their shape and flow like a sailor can sense the direction of the coming waves. His gut told him to go north. So he set off across a broad triangular intersection and onto a vacant lot strewn with rubble. The heavy odor of diesel and cigarettes faded behind him, and his shadow grew longer in front as he walked. It led the way to rows of narrow, parallel streets lined with similar brick buildings, stained with soot. It felt industrial, but decayed and hollow. Reacher didn't know what kinds of businesses had thrived in Nashville's past, but whatever had been made or sold or stored, it had clearly happened around there, and it clearly wasn't happening anymore. The structures were all that remained. And not for much longer, Reacher thought. Either money would flow in and shore them up, or they'd collapse. Reacher stepped off the crumbling sidewalk and continued down the center of the street. He figured he'd give it another 2 blocks, 3 at the most. If he hadn't found anything good by then, he'd strike out to the right toward the river. He passed a place that sold part-worn tires, a warehouse that a charity was using to store donated furniture. Then, as he crossed the next street, he picked up the rumble of a bass guitar and the thunder of drums. The sound was coming from a building in the center of the block. It didn't look promising. There were no windows, no signage, just a thin strip of yellow light escaping from beneath a single wooden door. Reacher didn't like places with too few potential exits, so he was inclined to keep walking. But as he drew level, the door opened. 2 guys, maybe in their late 20s with sleeveless t-shirts and a smattering of anemic tattoos, stumbled out onto the sidewalk. Reacher moved to avoid them, and at the same moment, a guitar began to wail from inside. Reacher paused. The riff was good. It built and swelled and soared, and just as it seemed to be done and its final note was dying away, a woman's voice took over. It was mournful, desperate, agonizing, like a conduit to a world of the deepest imaginable sorrow. Reacher couldn't resist. He stepped across the threshold. The air inside smelled of beer and sweat, and the space was much shallower front to back than Reacher had expected. It was also wider, effectively creating two separate areas with a dead zone down the middle. The right-hand side was for the music lovers. There were a couple dozen that night, some standing, some dancing, some doing a bit of both. The stage was beyond them, against the far wall, taking up the full depth of the room. It was low, built out of beer crates with some kind of wooden sheeting nailed across the top. There was a modest speaker stack at each side, and a pair of metal bars hanging from the ceiling to hold the lights. The singer was front and center. She seemed tiny to Reacher, 5 feet tall at the most, and as thin as a needle. Her hair was in a perfect blonde bob that shone so brightly Reacher wondered if it was a wig. The guitar player was to her left, nearest the door. The bassist mirrored him on her right. They both had wild curly hair and high sharp cheekbones, and looked so alike they could have been twins. Certainly brothers. The drummer was there too, pounding out the beat, but the shadow at the back of the stage was too deep for Reacher to see her clearly. The left-hand side was for drinking. There were 6 round tables, each with 4 chairs, and 4 stools at the bar, which was set against the wall opposite the stage. It was kitted out with the usual array of beer pumps and bottle fridges and spirit dispensers. A mirror ran its full width with a jagged star-shaped fracture midway up in the center, the result of a bottle being thrown, Reacher thought. He liked the way it looked. It added character. But it wasn't enough to outweigh the biggest flaw in the place, the section of ceiling in front of the bar. Hanging from it were dozens of bras, maybe hundreds. There were all kinds of styles and colors and sizes. Where they'd come from, Reacher didn't want to know. It seemed sleazy to him, unnecessary, and bad from a practical point of view. To get to the bar, anyone reasonably tall would have to either push his way through or stoop down beneath them. Reacher waited until the band finished their last song, then bent at the waist and pivoted around until he was close enough to snag a bar stool. He was the only one on that side of the room, and he couldn't tell from the bartender's blank expression whether that was a situation he was happy with or not. "Coffee," Reacher said when the bartender finally acknowledged him. "Black." "Don't have coffee," the bartender replied. "Okay. Cheeseburger, fries, no lettuce, no pickle, and a Coke." "Don't have cheeseburgers." "What food do you have?" "Don't have food." "Where around here does?" The bartender shrugged. "Don't live around here." Reacher took his Coke and turned to look at the stage. He was hoping another band would set up, but there was no sign of activity. Half the audience had drifted across and congregated around the tables. The rest had already made for the door. With no more music and no hope of any food, Reacher figured he might as well finish his drink and follow them out. He continued in the direction he'd been going before he was lured inside, but when he reached the alley at the far end of the building, he heard a scuffling noise. He turned and almost collided with the guitar player from the band he'd just heard. The guy took a step back, his eyes wide with fear and his guitar case raised like a shield. The singer almost piled into him from behind. Reacher held up his hands, palms facing out. He was aware of the effect his appearance could have. He was 6'5", 250 pounds. His hair was a disheveled mess. He was unshaved. Children had been known to run screaming at the sight of him. "I'm sorry, guys." Reacher attempted a reassuring smile. "I didn't mean to startle you." The guitarist lowered his case, but he didn't step forward. "Great performance tonight, by the way," Reacher said. "When are you playing again?" "Thanks." The guitarist stayed back. "Soon, I hope." "Here?" "No chance." "Why? Bad crowd?" "No. Bad owner." "Wait." The singer glared up at Reacher. "Why are you here? Do you work for him?"
"I don't work for anyone," Reacher said. "But what's bad about the owner? What's the problem?"
The singer hesitated, then held up one finger, then another.
He wouldn't pay us, and he ripped us off. He stole a guitar.
One of mine, the guitarist said. My good spare.
Really? Reacher stepped back. That doesn't sound like good business practice. There has to be more to the story.
Like what?
The singer looked at the guitarist.
Like nothing, he said. We finished our set, packed up, asked for our money. He refused.
I don't get it.
Reacher paused.
A place like this. Music's the draw. Not the decor, that's for damn sure.
You need bands to have music. And if you don't pay the bands, how do you get them to play?
Sounds like a self-defeating strategy to me.
You must have done something to piss him off.
You don't get the music business.
The guitarist shook his head.
Explain it to me.
Why?
Why? Because I'm asking you to.
I like information. Learning is a virtue.
The guitarist rested his case on the ground. What's to explain? This kind of thing happens all the time. There's nothing we can do about it.
Bands don't have the power. The singer put her hand on the guitarist's shoulder.
The venues do.
Isn't there anyone who could help you put things right? Your manager, your agent. Don't musicians have those kinds of people?
The guitarist shook his head. Successful musicians, maybe. Not us.
Not yet, the singer said.
The police, then?
No.
The singer's hand brushed her jacket pocket.
No police.
We can't involve them, the guitarist said. We get a name for being difficult, no one will book us.
What's the point in getting booked if you don't get paid?
The point is, we get to play.
People hear us.
The singer tapped the side of her head.
You can't get discovered if you don't get heard.
I guess. Reacher paused. Although, if I'm honest, I think you need to consider the message you're sending.
What message?
The guitarist leaned one shoulder against the wall.
Suck it up. That's all we can do. That's how we're going to make it, the singer said. In the end.
Reacher said nothing.
What?
You think we're doing the wrong thing?
Maybe I'm out of line.
Reacher looked at each of them in turn. But it seems to me you're telling the club owners it's okay to rip you off. That you're happy not to get paid.
That's crazy, the singer said. I hate not getting paid. It's the worst.
Did you make that clear?
Of course.
The guitar player straightened up.
I did. I insisted he pay us. He made like he was going to and took me to his office.
Only a guy was waiting there. The bouncer.
He's huge. They must have planned the whole thing in advance because he didn't say anything. Didn't wait. Just grabbed my hand. My left.
He held up his left hand to emphasize the point.
He grabbed it and pushed it down onto the desk, where there's this kind of metal plate. It's all dented and stained. Anyway, he held my hand there, and the owner went around the desk and opened the top drawer. He took out a hammer, used the claw thing to spread my fingers apart, then said I had to choose. We could have the money, and he'd break my fingers, one at a time. Or I could leave, unhurt, with no cash.
Reacher was conscious of a voice in his head telling him to walk away, saying this wasn't his problem. But he had heard how the guy could make a guitar wail. He remembered watching his fingers when he was on stage. They were the opposite of Reacher's own, quick and delicate, dancing across the strings. He pictured the thug grabbing his hand, the owner wielding the hammer. He stayed where he was.
If you like, I could go back in there, Reacher said. Help the owner see things from a different angle. Maybe get him to reconsider tonight's fee.
You could do that?
The singer didn't look convinced.
I've been told I can be very persuasive.
You could get hurt.
Someone could.
Not me.
He has a hammer.
The guitarist shuffled on the spot. I doubt the hammer will come into play. And there wouldn't be a problem if it did. So why don't I give it a try? What have you got to lose?
Thank you. The singer cut him off. We appreciate any help you can give us. Just please be careful.
I always am, Reacher said. Now tell me about the guitar, your good spare. The guy really stole it.
The big one did, the guitarist said. Kind of. He followed me down from the office and snatched it. Then he tossed it down the stairs to the basement and looked at me all weird, like he was daring me to go get it. You left it there? The guitarist looked away. Don't feel bad. That was the right move. Reacher paused. Was it worth much? A grand, maybe? The guitarist shrugged. That's a lot to me. And the owner, with the hammer, what's his name? Lockhart. Derek Lockhart. How much did he promise to pay you? $200. Okay. And aside from Lockhart, the guy who was with him in the office and the bartender, who else works there? No one. There is someone, the singer said. The kid who busses tables. He's out back most of the time smoking weed. Anyone else? No. Have you seen any weapons on the premises? They looked at each other and shook their heads. Okay, then. Where's Lockhart's office? Second floor, the guitarist said. Stairs are past the bathrooms. Back inside, a solitary customer was nursing his last bottle of beer. The barman was shoving a threadbare broom across the floor between the tables and the stage. There was no sign of anyone else, so Reacher made his way past the bathrooms and crept up the stairs. He saw one door leading off a narrow landing. It was closed. Reacher could hear a voice on the other side. It was male, he was sure of that. But he couldn't make out any words. They were soft, rhythmic, like someone counting, probably checking the week's take. So they'd likely be locked in. Reacher took hold of the handle, turned it, and simultaneously slammed his shoulder into the door. It gave easily, sending fragments of splintered wood spinning into the air. I'm sorry, gentlemen. Reacher stepped into the room and pushed the door back into its ruined frame. I didn't realize that was locked. The space was small, more like a closet than an office. Two men were crammed in behind the desk, shoulder to shoulder. The regular-sized guy Reacher took to be Lockhart. The other, a slack, flabby giant, would be the bouncer. Both were frozen in their seats, and the surface of the desk was covered with heaps of creased, greasy banknotes. Who the hell are you? It took Lockhart a moment to find his voice. My name's Jack Reacher. I represent the band that played for you tonight. I'm here to talk about their contract. They don't have a contract. They do now. Reacher took hold of a bent wood chair, which was the only other piece of furniture in the room, tested its strength, and sat down. Time for you to leave, Lockhart said. I only just got here. You can't be here. Not during the count. You didn't think that through all the way, did you? Lockhart paused, searching for a trap. What do you mean? You said I can't be here. And yet clearly I am. Faulty reasoning on your part. You can leave, Lockhart spoke with exaggerated clarity. Or I can throw you out. You can throw me out? Reacher allowed himself a smile. Lockhart's fist clenched on the desk in front of him. I can have you thrown out. Are you sure? Where are all your guys? I have all the guys I need right here. Lockhart pointed to his companion. Him? For a start, he's one guy, singular. So you'd have to say, the only guy I need. But that's not right either, is it? Because he's obviously not up to the job. I could be asleep, and he couldn't throw me out. I could have died of old age, and he still couldn't do it. Reacher was watching the big guy's eyes throughout the whole exchange. He saw them flicker toward Lockhart, saw Lockhart respond with the tiniest nod of his head. The big guy rose out of his chair. Reacher knew there was only one possible play that stood any chance of success. The guy could launch himself straight over the desk. If he was quick enough, he'd arrive before Reacher was on his feet. But even if Reacher was already standing, the guy would still have his most powerful weapon. His weight. He had at least 100 pounds on Reacher. Coupled with the speed he'd have gained diving forward, all those pounds would translate into some formidable momentum. There'd be no way for Reacher to counter it. He'd be knocked backward onto the floor, pinned down, jammed in the corner, unable to bring his fists or feet or elbows to bear, and unable to breathe. Then all the guy would have to do would be wait. Physics would finish the fight for him. He could just lie there till Reacher passed out. It would be the easiest victory he ever won. The guy made the wrong choice. Instead of diving over the table, he tried to shimmy around it. That was a serious mistake for someone with his build. Reacher's goading had clouded his thinking. He wasn't focused on the win. He was picturing the pummeling he could dish out, which gave Reacher time to scoop up the metal plate from the desk, grip it securely with one edge against his palms, and drive it up into the guy's onrushing neck like a reversed guillotine blade, crushing his larynx and windpipe. Then Reacher shoved him square in the face, and the guy fell back in the direction he came from and landed, choking and spluttering, in the corner. "Normally I wouldn't have done that," Reacher said, settling back in his chair. "Not right off the bat. I'd have given him a chance to walk away. But then I remembered he was the one who took the kid's guitar. So I figured all bets were off." Lockhart was scrabbling for his phone. "We should call 911. Quick!" "Your friend will be fine," Reacher said. "Or maybe he won't. But in the meantime, while he's dealing with his breathing issues, let's get back to the band's contract. You promised to pay. How much?" "I promised nothing." Reacher ran his finger along the edge of the plate. "I think you did." Lockhart lunged sideways, going for his drawer. Reacher tracked his movement and tossed the plate, spinning it like a frisbee. It caught Lockhart on the bridge of his nose, shattering the bone and rocking him back in his chair. "I'm beginning to think this toy is dangerous." Reacher picked up the plate and dropped it on the floor. "You shouldn't play with it anymore. Now, the contract. Give me a number. $200. $200 was the original figure. But since it was agreed, you revealed an interest in human fingers. Tell me, how many are there on a guitar player's left hand, for example?"
5.
Lockhart's voice was muffled thanks to his restricted airway. "Technically, there are 4. The other digit is a thumb. But I'll take your answer. So, $200 multiplied by 5 is...
1,000.
Very good. That's our new figure. We take cash."
"Forget it.
There's plenty of cash here. If counting is too difficult for you, maybe I should just take all of it."
"All right."
Lockhart almost squealed. He selected 2 stacks of bills and slid them across the desk. "Good. Now let's add your late payment fee. That's an additional $500. Lockhart glowered and handed over another stack. "We're almost done now. Next up is the equipment replacement surcharge. Around $1,000.
"What the?"
"For the kid's guitar. Your buddy tossed it down some stairs. Get the money back from him if you want, but there's no way it's coming out of my client's pocket." Lockhart's eyes were flickering back and forth across his dwindling heap of cash. Reacher could almost see his brain working as he calculated how much he had left, and whether his chances of keeping any would improve if he cooperated. "Okay, another 1,000, but not 1 cent more. And tell those kids if they ever come back, I'll break more than their fingers. And even if they don't come here, they'll never play in this town again." Reacher shook his head. "We were doing so well, and you had to ruin it. You didn't let me finish. We'd covered the payments, but we hadn't gotten around to the incentives. This is important, so listen carefully. Every band member I represent has me on speed dial. If anything happens to any of them, I'll come back here. I'll break your arms, I'll break your legs, and I'll hang your underwear from the ceiling of the bar while you're still wearing it. Are we clear?" Lockhart nodded. "Good. Now, incentive number 2, other bands. Even if I don't represent them, I'm extending an umbrella agreement. As a courtesy, think of it as my contribution to the arts. What it means is that if I hear about you ripping off another band, I'll come back. I'll take all your money, and I'll hang your underwear from the ceiling of the bar, same way as before. Are we clear on that, too?" Lockhart nodded. "Excellent. And in case you were wondering, I'll be carrying out random spot checks to test for compliance. Now, when is the next band playing here?"
"Tomorrow."
"Okay. I hope they're as good as tonight's. But even if they're not, remember, they get paid.
Chapter 2 Rusty Rutherford was not normally the type of guy who dawdled in his local coffee shop. He went to the same one every day, always on his way to work, and purely for the caffeine. He didn't go in search of conversation. He wasn't interested in finding new company. His routine was always the same. He stood quietly in line and used the time to contemplate whatever problems were in store for him that day. He placed his order, collected his drink as soon as it was ready, and left. The process was transactional, not social. Even after the week he spent isolated in his apartment, it proved a difficult habit to break. The adjustment process wasn't made any easier by the response he received from the other patrons. Normally his was a pretty neutral presence. People weren't pleased to see him. They weren't displeased. They displayed no curiosity, no animosity. He could have been a store mannequin for all the effect he had on the social interactions that occurred in the place. That Monday, though, he felt like a magnet with the wrong polarity. He seemed to repel everyone around him. The surrounding customers left a bigger space than usual on either side. In the rare moments he was able to make eye contact, the other person turned away before he could think of a way to start a conversation. By the time he reached the counter, he still hadn't exchanged a single word with a fellow human being. But he had seen how the barista interacted with the two men in front of him when they stepped up to order. She smiled at them and asked if they wanted their regular. She didn't smile at him, and she didn't say a word. "My regular, please," Rusty said. "Which would be what?" she asked. Rusty heard someone sniggering behind him in the line. He felt the urge to run. But no. He was there on principle. To fight for his rights. A little ridicule was not going to break his resolve. "House blend, medium. No room for milk. $2 even." The barista turned, grabbed a to-go cup, and slammed it on the counter. "No." Rusty shook his head. "I want to drink it here." The barista shot him a look that said, "Really? I'd rather you didn't." "Oh, that's right," she said out loud. "I forgot. You lost your job. You don't have any place to go." She tossed the to-go cup in the trash, took out a china one, poured, slopping coffee into the saucer, and slid it toward him, spilling even more. The same time Rusty Rutherford was going into the coffee shop, a telephone was starting to ring. In a house a mile outside of town, in a room containing two people, a man and a woman. The woman recognized the ringtone the moment the phone began to chirp. She knew what it meant. Her boss was going to require privacy, so she stood up without waiting to be dismissed, closed her notebook, slid it into the pocket at the front of her apron, and made her way to the door. The man checked that the secure icon on the phone's screen was green, then hit the answer key. "This is Speransky." Speransky wasn't his real name, of course, but it might as well have been. He'd been using it professionally for more than 5 decades. The voice at the other end of the line said one word. "Contact." Speransky closed his eyes for a moment and ran the fingers of his free hand through his wild white hair. It was about time. He had made plenty of plans over the years, been involved in plenty of operations, survived plenty of crises, but never had the stakes been so high. For him. Personally, and for the only person in the world he cared about. The same time the telephone was being answered, Jack Reacher was getting into a car. He had solved his physics-biology conundrum to his satisfaction, and the bar owner's extreme discomfort, and begun walking back to the bus station. He had been planning to follow his time-served principle of taking the first bus to leave, regardless of its destination, when he heard a vehicle approaching slowly from behind. He stuck out his thumb on the off chance, and to his surprise, the car stopped. It was new and shiny and bland. A rental. Probably picked up at the airport. The driver was a tidy-looking guy in his early 20s.
He was wearing a plain dark-colored suit, and the speed of his breathing and the pallor of his face suggested he wasn't far from a full-blown panic attack. A businessman, Reacher thought, let out alone for the first time, desperate not to screw anything up, and therefore screwing up everything he touched.
Excuse me, sir?
The guy sounded even more nervous than he looked.
Do you know the way to I-40? I need to go west.
He gestured at a screen on his dashboard.
The GPS in this thing hates me. It keeps trying to send me down streets that don't exist.
Sure, Reacher said, but it's hard to explain. It would be easier to show you. The guy hesitated and looked Reacher up and down as if only just taking in his height, the breadth of his chest, his unwashed hair, his unshaved face, the web of scars around the knuckles of his enormous hands. Unless you'd prefer to keep driving aimlessly around. Reacher attempted a concerned expression. The guy swallowed.
Where are you going?
Anywhere. I-40 is as good a place to start as any.
Well, okay.
The guy paused.
I'll take you to the highway. But I'm not going far after that.
A place you'd want to go, I'm sure. How much farther?
75 miles, maybe?
Some small town near a place named Pleasantville.
Sounds inspiring, huh?
Do they have a coffee shop in this town? The guy shrugged.
Probably. I can't say for sure.
I've never been there before. Probably is good enough for me, Reacher said. Let's go.
Rutherford picked up the cup and realized he had another unfamiliar dilemma to face. Where should he sit? Deciding wasn't a problem, normally. He didn't stay. And he didn't have a dozen angry eyes probing him while he searched for an answer. He fought the urge to skulk at the back of the store. That would be the least uncomfortable option, for sure. But it would hardly serve his purpose. He didn't want a window seat, either. He wasn't ready to put himself on display quite so prominently. So he opted for a small, square table in the center. It had two chairs covered in red vinyl, and its top had writing scrawled across every square inch of its surface. By previous customers, he guessed, there were song lyrics, poems, uplifting sayings. He scanned the words, found none he felt any connection to, then forced himself to look up. He attempted to make eye contact with the people at the other tables, and failed, except with a toddler, whose parents got up and left when they realized what was going on. Rusty sipped at his coffee. He wanted to make it last at least an hour. He worked his way down to the dregs, and still achieved no interaction with anyone but the barista, who missed no opportunity to shoot him hostile glares. He refilled his cup and changed tables. Neither thing brought a change of luck. He stuck it out for another 40 minutes, and then the barista approached and told him to either order some food or leave.
I won't order any food, Rusty told her. I'll leave. But I'll come back tomorrow. And the next day. And every day after that until everyone believes I'm innocent.
The barista gave him a blank look and retreated to the counter.
Rusty stood up.
Listen to me, he said.
No one paid any attention.
Listen to me,
Rusty raised his voice.
What happened to the town totally sucks. I get that. But it was not my fault. None of it. The truth is, I tried to stop it from happening. And I was the only one who did.
No one paid any attention. The barista leaned across the counter with a to-go cup in her hand.
Take this and leave, Mr. Rutherford. No one believes you. And no one ever will.
The same time Rusty Rutherford was leaving the coffee shop, Jack Reacher was arriving in his town. Getting out of Nashville hadn't been a problem. Reacher had navigated using his instinct, plus the landmarks he remembered from Saturday night's bus ride, and had found the highway without getting them lost. Not so lost that the driver noticed, anyway. Once they were out of the city, Reacher persuaded him to tune the radio to a local blues channel, then reclined his seat and closed his eyes. The music was half-decent, but despite that, the guy wouldn't stop talking. About New York, the insurance company he worked for. This was his first case after getting a promotion to negotiator,
flying out that morning for a meeting at their field office, getting lost on his way to whichever town had whatever kind of problem he was supposed to help solve. Something to do with computers, and foreign governments, and keys and portals and all kinds of other things Reacher had no interest in. He let the words wash over him and settled into a comfortable doze, only opening his eyes when he felt the car slow and they turned onto a state highway heading south. The half-mile beyond the Cloverleaf was teeming with restaurants and drive-thrus and car dealers and chain hotels. After that, the terrain opened out. There were farmers' fields where the land was flat, stretched and warped into all kinds of irregular shapes by the sweeping contours, and groves of tall mature trees where the land was steep. After 10 minutes, they swung west again and continued along a steeper, twistier road for the best part of an hour, until they entered the outskirts of the town. The guy kept driving until they found what Reacher guessed was the main street, then pulled over. Reacher climbed out and took stock of his new surroundings. The place was unobjectionable, he thought. A late 19th-century core supplemented by an influx of cash in the 50s, judging by the buildings. Some old ones weeded out, some newer ones to fill the gaps, now showing their own age. The overall layout unchanged. A standard grid, compact enough to require traffic signals at one intersection only. They were out that day, which was causing consternation amongst some of the passing drivers. But aside from that, things were fine. Good enough for a pit stop, anyway. Reacher figured he could pass a half hour there. There was no ancestral connection, no intriguing name, no military significance, no interesting signs or structures, no link to any of his musical heroes, no reason to stay. No longer than it took to get coffee, anyway. Priorities were priorities. Reacher was half a block from the intersection with the broken signals at the west end of what he figured was the town's main drag. There was a coffee shop diagonally opposite. There may have been others elsewhere in the town, but Reacher saw no reason to check. He wasn't fussy. So he took advantage of the traffic chaos and started out across the street. Reacher was heading for the coffee shop. Rutherford was leaving it. Reacher didn't pay him much attention at first. He was just a guy. Small and unremarkable, holding his to-go cup, going about his business. Whatever that may be. But a moment later, Reacher's interest ratcheted all the way up. He felt a chill at the base of his neck, a signal from some ancient warning system hardwired into the back of his brain, an instinctive recognition, pattern and movement, predators circling, moving in on their prey, two men and a woman, spread out, carefully positioned, coordinated, ready to spring their trap. 3 against 1. Not the kind of odds to worry Reacher. But Reacher was not their target. That was clear. The men were positioned at each end of the block. One was pretending to look in a store window at the west end, right before the intersection with the broken signals. The other was at the east end, where the block ended at an alleyway, pretending to do something with his phone. An envelope of maybe 130 feet. The woman was stationed on the other side of the alleyway, at the start of the next block, another 10 feet away. There was a solid row of buildings to the north of the sidewalk, the street to the south. Store entrances to bolt into if the timing was right, asphalt to run across if no traffic was coming. Rutherford was heading east, not hurrying, not dawdling, just drifting along in his own little bubble. Not aimless, Reacher thought, more like preoccupied. Following a familiar route, comfortable with his surroundings, not paying attention, not looking for store entrances, not checking the traffic. The West End guy was around 5'10". He was wearing a plain black t-shirt and cargo pants. His hair was buzzed short, and he had an earpiece like the kind Reacher had seen business people use. The East End guy was the same kind of size. He had the same clothes, the same hair, the same earpiece. The woman on the other side of the alley was also wearing black, but her clothes were more fitted and her hair wasn't buzzed. It was long and red, and she had it tied back in a ponytail. The West End guy peeled away from his window and started walking, heading east, 15 feet behind Rutherford, moving with loose, rangy ease. He was clearly having to shorten his stride to avoid overtaking his mark. Ahead of them, a woman had stopped at the edge of the sidewalk to tend to a child in a stroller.
Beyond her, a couple stood talking. They were dressed for the gym. Just regular folks, not part of the pattern, unaware of what was happening. The envelope was down to 100 feet. The East End guy touched his earpiece. A moment later, a car appeared in the mouth of the alley. It had rolled forward from somewhere deep in the shadows. An anonymous sedan. A Toyota, dark blue. Reacher saw it move rather than heard it. A hybrid in fully electric mode, he thought. A smart choice of vehicle. Too bad the 110th hadn't had them back in the day. The envelope was down to 80 feet. Reacher stepped onto the sidewalk. Rutherford approached the woman with the stroller. She stood up as he drew level. Her kid threw his teddy bear onto the ground. Rutherford leaned down and retrieved it. Maybe Rutherford wasn't as clueless as he appeared. It was a perfect maneuver to check the sidewalk behind him. Maybe Rutherford knew he was being followed after all. Then Reacher's optimism evaporated. Rutherford's eyes were only on the kid. He held out the toy. The woman snatched it away, glaring furiously. Rutherford continued walking. The envelope was down to 60 feet. Reacher changed course, started heading east, 30 feet behind the Western guy. The couple in gym clothes moved away from the wall. Their body language had hardened. Their conversation must have turned sour. The man strode forward, leading with his shoulder. He slammed into Rutherford, spilling his coffee. His partner caught up. She grabbed his arm and pulled him away, shaking her head and scowling. "Hey," Rutherford said. He didn't get a response. Turn around, Reacher thought. Ignore the gym rats. Notice the guy who's pursuing you. Rutherford didn't turn around. He carried on walking. The envelope was down to 40 feet, another 20 feet between Reacher and the Western guy. It was obvious what was going to happen next. Reacher could see it as clearly as if a skywriter had spelled it out with white smoke. The car would roll a little farther forward so that its rear door was level with the sidewalk. The Eastern guy would open it. The Western guy would push Rutherford inside and jump in himself. The woman would get in on the other side. The Eastern guy would take the passenger seat, and they'd drive away. Less than 5 seconds for the whole operation if they did it right. And it would be silent. No muss, no fuss. No one would see a thing. The envelope was 20 feet, 10 feet between Reacher and the Western guy. Decision time. It was 4 against 1 now. Maybe 5 or 6 against 1 if they had a mobile backup. Not the kind of odds to bother Reacher. But Reacher was not their target. The car moved up, right on cue. Rutherford stopped, thinking nothing of it. Just an impatient driver taking a shortcut through the alley. He took a sip of coffee, waiting for the car to pull away. It stayed put. One guy opened the back door and held it. The other quickened his pace. He stretched out. His left hand cupped the top of Rutherford's head. His right grabbed Rutherford's elbow. He started to steer him toward the back seat. But he was too slow. All he wound up pushing was empty air. The envelope was 0 feet. Reacher was level with the Western guy on his left-hand side. He took hold of Rutherford's collar, stuck his right arm across the Western guy's chest like a steel barrier, pivoted clockwise on his right foot, pushed Rutherford back and to the side, and held him there, out of anyone else's range. "Let's keep things civil," Reacher said. "Show me some ID, or get in the car and drive away." "Let him go," the Western guy said. "If you have a legitimate reason to detain him, you'll have some kind of official ID. If you do, show it to me. If you don't, drive away. This is your last chance." "Who the hell are you?" "Given the situation, you should stick to the relevant issues." "Who are you?" "I gave you 2 options. Asking irrelevant questions was not one of them." "Let him go." The guy went to step around Reacher, his arm stretched out, trying to grab Rutherford. Reacher hit him in the temple and he bounced off the wall and dropped like a puppet with its strings cut. Reacher turned to the other guy. "You've had your final chance. Pick up your trash and leave. Or don't, and get added to the pile. Make your choice. Either way's fine with me." Reacher caught movement out of the corner of his eye. The Toyota's passenger window was rolling down. The driver was lifting her arm. She was looking directly at him. Raising a gun? Reacher didn't wait to find out. He let go of Rutherford and spun the Eastern guy around so that he was facing the car, grabbed his collar and waistband, and launched him headfirst through the open window, jamming him in tight, his arms pinned and his legs kicking helplessly. Reacher stepped back to avoid the flailing feet and checked that Rutherford was still there, frozen to the spot. Then he sensed, rather than heard, a heavy object racing toward them. He grabbed Rutherford and shoved him back, and a moment later, a black Chevy Suburban lurched onto the sidewalk, stopping right where Reacher had been standing. The driver's door opened, and a man jumped out. He was shorter than the others, and wirier. Another man jumped down from the passenger side and joined him. They stood side by side for a moment, both in a version of some strange martial arts stance, then relaxed. They stepped forward. They were comfortable together. They had clearly done this kind of thing before. "Step aside, mister," the driver said. "This isn't your fight. The guy's coming with us." Reacher shook his head. "You're not taking him. That's a given. He walks away. The only question is, will you? Or do you have some strong urge to join your buddies in the hospital?" The driver didn't reply, and Reacher became aware of a scrabbling sound on the far side of the Suburban. The guy he'd thrown through the Toyota's window had wriggled free, and along with the woman from the alley was trying to maneuver their unconscious comrade into the back seat. A ring of onlookers had formed, starting on the sidewalk and spilling onto the street. It reminded Reacher of the crowds that would gather in the playgrounds on the first day of each new school he attended growing up. Him and his brother Joe, back to back, fighting them off. He looked at Rutherford. He wasn't trying to run, which was something, but Reacher knew he'd be no help if the mob turned nasty. The two guys exchanged glances. They were considering their next move. Stealth was out of the window, so it was down to a choice between a frontal assault or a tactical withdrawal. Neither option seemed to appeal. Then a siren started up. The pedestrians scattered. The car pulled away, its gas engine kicking in as the driver buried the accelerator. The wiry guys jumped back into the Suburban and slammed it into reverse, clipping the front corner of the leading police cruiser before racing into the distance. Rutherford stayed still, his eyes wide and his mouth hanging open. The pair of police cars stopped at the side of the street and killed their sirens and light bars. Four officers jumped out. Three converged immediately on the sidewalk. One lingered to inspect the damage to his car. All had their guns drawn, but not raised. They expected their numbers to give them the advantage, Reacher guessed, but were taking no chances, which seemed like a sensible attitude to take. "On the ground," the lead officer said. "Face down." "You're arresting us?" Reacher said. "What were you expecting? A lollipop? Get on the ground." Reacher didn't move. The officer stepped closer. "On the ground. Do it now." Cops are the same the world over. Once they commit to a position in public, they never back down. Trying to make them is a waste of time. Reacher knew that from personal experience. But still, there are standards to uphold. "All right," Reacher said. "I'll let you arrest us. We'll be released in 5 minutes anyway. But we're not getting on the ground." Chapter 3. The team's temporary base had been established the week before in a motel 8 miles west of town. Traffic was light, so theoretically the ground could be covered in 12 minutes without drawing unwelcome attention. But that afternoon, the occupants of both vehicles took substantially longer to get back. The guys from the Suburban made it first. It was easier for them since neither was injured. They started by heading 10 miles north. The driver, who went by the name Vasily, gave it an initial blast to get clear of the arriving police, then slowed to just above the limit until they reached a patch of waste ground behind a dense stand of trees. The place was secluded enough, but they knew better than to torch the damaged vehicle. That would be the same as texting a map to the cops and saying, "Here's the SUV you're looking for." And if it could be salvaged, the Suburban would still be a valuable asset. So they got to work. Vasily lined up on a concrete post at the end of a fence by the side of the road and slammed back into it. He pulled forward and repeated the maneuver, then climbed out to check the damage. It was satisfactory, he decided. Deep enough to obscure the dent sustained when they clipped the police car,
but not so extensive as to give a different cop an excuse to pull them over. He drove around behind the trees and wiped down the interior while his partner, who used the name Anatole, swapped the plates. Then they switched to their secondary vehicle for the final 13-mile diagonal stretch. Natasha was driving the Toyota. She started out going south for 6 miles. She took it very easy. She had an additional reason to drive slowly. She was worried about two of her companions. The one Reacher threw through the window, Petya, had wound up with an injured shoulder. Natasha wasn't sure if the damage had been done going in or wriggling out. He had kept quiet at the time, but now his face was pale and he groaned every time they hit a bump or a pothole. Ilya, the guy Reacher had hit, was still out cold. Natasha was concerned about concussion and didn't want to cause any additional damage. She wanted both of them back in the game as soon as humanly possible. It was hard not to paint what had happened that afternoon as anything but a failure. With failure comes the danger of replacement. That danger grows if the team is left under strength, and that danger had to be avoided at all costs. After 15 minutes, they pulled into a lot belonging to a chintzy roadside diner. Natasha switched plates, while the other woman, Sonia, helped Petya into their secondary vehicle. Together, the two women transferred the unconscious Ilya and sanitized the Toyota's interior. Then they set out for the motel, looping farther west than strictly necessary, which stretched the final leg out to 12 miles. Natasha had taken her time at each stage of the journey, partly due to thorough training, partly due to taking pride in doing the job right, but mainly due to how little she was looking forward to the next step in the process, the report. Making the call presented no major difficulty. There was no particular challenge in describing what had happened. She knew that her contact would listen without interruption. He'd save any questions he might have until she'd finished speaking. He'd hang up. And then there would be the wait. For the verdict. Continue. Or stand down. A fighting chance. Or disaster. The information would flow up the chain of command until a decision was reached. Who that involved or where they were located, Natasha didn't know. The system was designed that way. For security. Compartmentalization was king in the world she currently inhabited. She suspected there must be a local connection. Someone with their ear to the ground. Who raised the alarm in the first place. Who may or may not still be involved. Who may or may not have a say in the outcome. Identifying him or her would be possible, she supposed. Maybe necessary. Certainly desirable. But that was a problem for the future. Right then, all she had to worry about was keeping her team, and therefore herself, in the field. The lead officer took care of searching Reacher. He was thorough and slow. Rutherford was in the back of the first car before the officer got as far as